All right, well then, I'm delighted to open the first of our public sessions of the new council. Want to express my appreciation to all of you for your willingness to serve. We have many continuing members and a significant number of new faces. We also have some people who thought they were retired, including Patrice, who was assured that having served two full terms, that was more than enough. Let's say I'm pleased that the trustees put particular emphasis on continuity at this point in time, and a number of members were extended to a seventh and as much as anything is final year on their term. The approach to the composition of the council, I think, is very consistent with the previous one, which is encouraging, I think, in terms of we're perceived as being working, contributing positively to the system overall. In particular, the aspect of most of us coming in a representative capacity has been retained, and that, in my judgment, has proved very effective. We now have staggered terms, some of us appointed for 1, 2, or maximum of 3 years, which strikes a balance between providing continuity and allowing opportunities for those who are not at the table to join us and get fresh views and perspectives. It's very encouraging. We had many expressions of interest, many people keen to join the council, and that's excellent. I think people understand that the trustees face very difficult decisions in striking a balance between the competing interests and just the large number of expressions of interest in participating in the council. We have a broader and deeper coverage in this council, I think, than we've had in the past. The trustees have reached out to particular sectors as either in terms of geography or background, where we're not represented in the last council, and others where more depth in terms of, I think, our academic colleague on the last council probably felt a bit lonely being one out of 50. And so one of the things that have been done is to increase the number of our colleagues from the academic community. Collectively, we are, I think, a very impressive group of well-connected individuals, well-connected organizations. Our challenge really is to take maximum benefit of the talents and resources that we have collectively in terms of progressing the work of the ISB and IFRS. I think at this point, because there are a number of new faces that even though we are a large group, it's worth taking a few minutes and going around the table and simply introducing ourselves and perhaps the organization that we represent. So perhaps, Charles, if I could start with you.
Thank you, Paul. My name is Charles Masek. I'm based in Melbourne, Australia. I spent my executive career in financial services, so I have very much a user or investor perspective. The last 10 years, I've been a non-executive director on a number of companies, public and private, including some very large ones, and I was a foundation member of the Financial Reporting Council in Australia that was set up at the end of 1999, and for 5 years, from 2003 to 2007, I was its chairman, and that is probably why I'm here.
Patrice Marteau, French, former CFO, chairman of Acteo, French organization for account, international accounting, and chairman of accounting group in Business Europe.
Alan Teixeira, ISB staff, I'm a senior technical director. Sue Lloyd, ISB staff, Joint Senior Director of Technical Activities.
Good morning, I'm Yael Almog. I'm the new Executive Director for the IFRS Foundation. I come from Israel, and I served at the Israel Securities Authority for the last 5 years.
Michael Stewart, Director of Implementation Activities at the ISB and primarily responsible for looking after the work of the Interpretations Committee.
I'm Jon Baldus, Technical Manager at the ISB.
And Stephen Cooper, ISB Board Member.
Jeff Mahoney, I'm General Counsel of the Council of Institutional Investors. We're based in Washington, D.C., represent public, corporate, and union employee benefit plans that have about $3 trillion invested in the capital markets. And we have a growing number of non-domestic plans who have become members as well.
I'm Vincent Papa. I'm here representing CFA Institute, basically bringing forward the investor perspective, and I'm based here in London.
I'm Gerard Eve from the Singapore Accounting Standards Council.
Richard Thorpe from the UK Financial Services Authority. I'm here as chairman of the International Association of Insurance Supervisors Accounting and Auditing Issues Subcommittee.
My name is Su Zhonghuang, and I'm a professor of accounting and vice president of Xiamen National Accounting Institute. Our institute is an academy organization providing trainings for CPAs, CFOs.
Madam Yang Ming, Director General Accounting Regulator Department of Ministry of Finance of China, and also the Secretary General of China Accounting Standards Committee.
I'm Wei Guo, the ISB board member from China.
Charity St. Pierre Group of North American Insurance Enterprises.
My name is Rudy Bless. I'm here representing Financial Executives International. My day job is with Credit Suisse, where I'm the deputy CFO.
Seiji Kaneko, representing the Securities Analyst Association of Japan.
I'm Joel Osnas, a partner with Deloitte, the U.S. firm of Deloitte, and I'm the leader of the IFRS clients and markets for Deloitte globally.
Françoise Flores, chairman of the European Financial Reporting Advisory Group.
Judith Downs, representing the Group of 100 from Australia, the larger companies in Australia.
Riaz Miller, chairman of the Accounting and Auditing Standards Committee of the South Asian Federation of Accountants.
Benoit Tangana Onana, representing the International Federation of Accountants. I'm former chairman of the Institute of Chartered Accountants of Cameroon and senior partner of African Consulting Enterprise.
Morning, I'm Karen Brooks. I'm here representing Financial Executives International Canada. And in my day job, I'm Senior Vice President and Controller of Bell Canada, which is Canada's largest telecom company.
Good morning. My name is Laurent de Gabriel. I'm working for the European Securities Market Authority based in Paris.
Good morning. I'm Michael Bradbury. I'm representing the International Association for Accounting, Education and Research, and I'm a professor at Massey University in Auckland, New Zealand.
Good morning. I'm William Widdowson. I'm representing the Institute of International Finance.
Good morning, I'm Sanon Kim. I'm a Vice Chairman of Korea Accounting Standard Board. People, you know, you, most of you understand that I am one of the survivors from the layoff last year. Thank you.
Christoph Hütten, representing European Roundtable and European Issuers. In my day job, I'm Chief Accounting Officer of Software Vendor SAP.
Morning, Philippe Danjou. I'm a board member. I've been on the board since 2006, I guess, and I'm also a survivor because I was on the first advisory council back in 2001, I guess.
Good morning, Roger Marshall, Chairman, UK Accounting Standards Board.
Mark Fassen, I'm a partner with KPMG, and I'm the global IFRS network leader for KPMG.
My name is Thomas Blueing. I'm representing the Standards SC1 Committee of IASCO, and in my day job, I'm the head of accounting and auditing of the Federal Ministry of Justice in Berlin.
Good morning. My name is Panayotis Trousas. I represent the European Central Bank. I am head of Financial Services Policy Division.
Yeah, good morning. Fumio Muraoka. I'm representing the Nippon Keidanren, which is Japan Business Federation. And I'm the former CFO and now chairman of the Audit Committee of Toshiba Corporation. Thank you.
Jim Silf, the International Federation of Accountants in New York and Toronto. I'm here representing the International Federation, but particular interest in public sector accounting and auditing standards.
My name is Francis Ruijgt. I'm from the Netherlands, and I'm representing the International Actuarial Association.
And my name is Leo van der Tas. I'm the Global IFRS Technical Director at Ernst & Young.
Good morning. My name is Simon Bradbury. I'm the head of accounting policy at the World Bank based in Washington, D.C.
Good morning. I'm Liz Murrell. I'm here representing the Association of British Insurers and the Investment Management Association in the UK as institutional investors. My day job is I'm director of corporate governance reporting at the Investment Management Association.
Good morning, my name is Anne Molyneux, and I'm here representing the International Corporate Governance Network, again, institutional investors. For my day job, I'm a consultant in financial reporting and corporate governance, largely with the World Bank Group and the OECD.
Good morning, my name is Bruce McKenzie. I'm representing the Financial Reporting Standards Council of South Africa. I'm also the managing partner of W Consulting, which is a global IFRS consultancy.
Hello, my name is April McKenzie. It's very curious to be sitting next to a gentleman whose surname is exactly the same as mine. Nobody tell my husband. I'm a partner in Grant Thornton. I'm the global head of governance and public policy. This is a New Zealand accent, but I am based, not a South African accent, I'll point out, sitting next to me. A New Zealand accent, and I'm based in New York.
Good morning, Sylvie Matera. I'm representing here the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision, and my day job is Deputy Director General of the Bank of France in charge of operations.
Good morning. I'm Sankaraya, representing Associated Chamber of Commerce of India. Currently, I'm working as Executive Director of Finance of Jubilant Life Sciences and the Group Finance Director for the entire group. Thank you.
Good morning, Tak Och, IASB board member. I joined the board July last year from Japan.
Good morning, Andrew Buchanan. I'm a partner at BDO, and I'm our international network's global head of IFRS based in London.
Good morning, my name is Claude Bocaraz. I'm representing the European Commission.
Good morning, my name is Carlson Tong. I represent the Hong Kong Institute of CPA. I'm a former chairman of KPMG Asia Pacific region.
Hi, good morning. My name is Makoto Sonoda. I'm here as a representative of the Japan Financial Services Agency.
Hello, my name is Begoña Giner. I am representing the European Accounting Association of Academics. I am the president of the association at this moment. I'm professor of accounting and finance at the University of Valencia in Spain.
John Hitchens, UK partner in PricewaterhouseCoopers and our global IFRS leader.
Good morning, I'm Valesca Barros. I'm here to represent Abrasa, which is the Brazilian listed companies. And for my day job, I'm a former controller of Ike Batista Group, which focuses on natural resources and utilities.
Good morning, I'm Jim Croker, Chief Accountant, U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission.
Good morning, I'm Mark Byatt, Director of Communications and External Affairs for the IFRS Foundation.
Wayne Upton, IASB Director of International Activities. I also chair the Interpretations Committee and the Emerging Economies Committee.
Morning. I'm Antonio Zoido. I'm a trustee of the board of IFRS and chairman of the Spanish exchanges.
Good morning, everyone. I'm David Sidwell. I'm a trustee and I chair the Due Process Oversight Committee.
Good morning. I'm Ian McIntosh, vice chairman of the ISB.
Good morning. I'm Hans Hogevorst, chair of the IASB.
Thank you, everyone. And I try to be a neutral party, so I'm not here representing any particular organization, although a standard setter by background. Before moving on to the other agenda items, I thought we should take a couple of minutes to reflect on the experience of the past 3 years. As you know, we went through a performance evaluation exercise led by Charles, very worthwhile. I think it has identified a number of things for us to consider as we move forward in the next few years. So I would encourage you all to refer back to that paper. I certainly do from time to time to make sure we're not losing sight of the various suggestions that were brought forward. I think we have consensus that at this point in time, our efforts should be primarily focused on serving the needs of those who are using or moving to adopting IFRS as the foremost area of concern, that the issue of the consistent interpretation and application of IFRS is hugely important at this juncture, perhaps more so than generating new and improved standards, although there will always be a need for that sort of activity. In terms of our work, we have performed best when we are clear as to what we're trying to do, what the purpose of the various sessions is. That is something that the agenda committee discusses. There is a range of objectives. Some of our sessions are to provide information to members. Some of that can be done offline, but there's no substitute really for firsthand in contact with those who are responsible for those activities. So some of our sessions are primarily of an information nature. Others are sessions where we want outcomes. I would remind all of us that, you know, we are not a board of directors. We don't control the technical agenda. Our role is advisory. Has tremendous value. It often falls short of making decisions. We did feel there might be more opportunity to test the waters to see if we have consensus on particular issues. If we do, terrific. We will communicate that. If there is a range of views, that can be as useful or more useful than consensus. Where there is a range of views, we will endeavor to reflect that range of views in the reports that are communicated to the trustees, the board, and the public at large. But and the final aspect that has come out time and time again is wanting to close the loop in terms of feedback so that we have a sense that our time is being well spent, that it is being considered in the process. And we've made considerable improvement. The participation of trustees at this meeting, the other meetings, is, I think, a significant part of that communications mechanism, likewise with the board. So that's just something that we need to be conscious of going forward. But if we want feedback, we've got to be pretty clear as to what we're saying, and that requires a certain discipline on our part, I think, to be as clear as we can be in terms of the messages that we want to communicate. And having done that, we will endeavor to get feedback. I must say I was very heartened when you look at the agenda consultation. We'll be getting into that later today and the request for views. I mean, the role that the council played, to me, comes across very clearly in that document. So if we ever had any doubts that we were being heard, in my mind, that document in particular demonstrates very clearly that our views are taken into account. Doesn't necessarily mean that the board, the trustees will always agree with us, but the objective is to make sure that our views are heard and considered. So that process, I think, is playing out reasonably well. We will continue the practice of having breakout sessions to allow more in-depth discussion and exchange of views and reporting back. And certainly want to thank members who have agreed to act as the discussion leaders for those sessions. And I guess I would caution all of you, you're all fair game as far as I'm concerned. If we want these sessions, we've got to put some effort into leading them and reporting back. So I would ask you to indulge us when we approach you to play that role, because it's very important so that you feel that your views are coming forward and are not being filtered. And that's really what we're trying to do, to be as neutral as we can. My observation is, I don't know if any of the rest of you ever thought you'd be excited about financial reporting stuff, but at this juncture, if you look forward over the next 2 or 3 years, I think we are in a truly unique point in time in the evolution of IFRS and the IASB. If ever there was a need for broad-based, thoughtful participation on a global scale, you know, it's now. We need continuity. There is a lot of value in institutional memory, which is a real challenge when you have all the committees and volunteers coming and going. I see this group as playing a role in that institutional memory, that we ought not to assume that people have followed all of these discussions over time, are aware of issues that have been considered, and why certain issues cause people to go up in a sheet of flames, as I was saying, not again. It is important, in my experience, that as we go along, that we not underestimate, or put it the other way around, that we not overestimate the level of awareness that the world at large has for some of these very important issues. And I think council has a role to play in a bit of a stabilizing effect, if you will, to demonstrate that there is institutional memory, that issues are carefully considered, not lost sight of, that is an aspect of our work that is important and very useful as we try and bring issues forward and hopefully to a conclusion. So I think the next 2 to 3 years in this group will be particularly interesting if we pick our spots wisely, working with our agenda committee, that we are well positioned to provide the sort of advice that I think both the board and the trustees need. If you look around the world, I don't see any other group that is in as good a position, given the resources collectively represented around the table. So there's a challenge. I am optimistic that we will be very influential, and many areas are open to us to provide our views and advice. With that by way of background, I think I'll turn first to Charles and then to Patrice to see if there's anything you'd like to share by way of opening remarks, and then we'll move into the rest of the agenda.
Thank you, Paul. Obviously, I don't represent any particular organization, but I do spend a lot of time engaging with both the director community and the investor community in Australia. And it's fair to say that probably the single biggest concern that those two groups have with regard to IFRS would be the what they perceive to be the increasing complexity and As a result, there's been a trend in Australia to increasingly report to investors using not just the IFRS statutory reports, but also some additional non-GAAP type measures. And KPMG in Australia have been undertaking a survey for, I think, the last 3 years. The latest one I've forwarded to Jan, and it is on the Council's website, and I encourage everyone to have a quick look at it. It's a very easy read, but I'll just hit just a couple of the highlights of the latest report, which relates to the financial reporting for the last financial year, which in Australia ends in June. Some 82% of the top 100 companies used some non-statutory profit information. 73% showed that the non-statutory profit figure was higher than the IFRS statutory profit, which I guess justifies some cynicism. 90% did provide a reconciliation between the two figures. And some 61%, which is down from 72% in the previous year, actually gave prominence to the non-statutory report, which obviously is an important issue in terms of ensuring consistency of application. On a more pleasing note, the adjustments from 1 year to the next seem to be applied in a consistent fashion. The main adjustments related to fair value of financial instruments, income tax, mergers, integration and results from the sale of business operations, impairment testing and redundancies and restructuring costs. In response to that trend in Australia, the regulator, the Securities Investment Commission, undertook a process last year starting with a discussion paper that culminated in a regulatory guidance being issued in December. This guidance does not have the same force of law as a regulation which prescribes absolute compliance, but I think the Commission has arrived at a balanced position, recognising its role as the regulator, where it needs to ensure compliance with IFRS, which is the reporting standard in Australia, and yet recognising the needs of the market participants for information that they find relevant. And of course, the challenge there is that the investor community is quite diverse, and therefore different participants, both on the sell side and the buy side, may look for different information. The main highlights of that guidance are that non-IFRS profit must be clearly identified separately from IFRS profit. There has to be a reconciliation, so a large number of companies that are not providing that will have to make a change. There should be a statement indicating why directors, of course it's the directors' accounts, why the directors believe that the presentation of non-IFRS profit is useful. Prominence should be given at all times to the statutory IFRS report. The final observation I'll make is because it has been circulated with the agenda papers, there's an article in the Australian Financial Review some couple of weeks ago looking at the particularly the preparer's view to IFRS. It was a somewhat negative article, which I think is most unfortunate because I don't think it truly reflects the degree of support in Australia. Typical journalism trying to sensationalise something, and I know that Judith Downs, who does represent G100, which is the community that was largely interviewed for that article, may well have some additional comments she might wish to make to provide some context to that article.
Thanks, Charles. Judith, anything you wanted to add, or?
It might be appropriate to finalise the comments on this article now, Paul, if I could. I'd like to be very clear that the G100 members who were quoted in the article do fully support the adoption of IFRS in Australia. Adopting IFRS has been a step forward for Australian companies as compared to using Australian-specific standards. And G100 does provide constructive input to the development of IFRS, including papers that I've presented at this council in the past. As Charles has said, the comments were rather selective, designed to give a story. I would always expect that the development of any accounting standard creates controversy. And that, of course, is what the journalist was after, some throwaway comments that said, well, people don't believe 100% of the standards are exactly what they would like to see. That is quite normal. It does not in any way reflect a lack of underlying support from Australia for IFRS and for the adoption of IFRS. If anyone's got any questions on the article, perhaps they could talk to me out of session.
Thanks, Judith. Patrice, what's happening in your neck of the woods?
I remember that just shortly after the former meeting, we invited in Paris the trustees to meet, because we took the opportunity of a meeting of the trustees to exchange with certain French people, notably preparers, but others. And I think it was a very unique opportunity to exchange, and with Hans too. Frenchies are often considered as speaking a little too much bluntly, maybe, or reacting too much. But I think it was a constructive meeting, because some head of big companies or smaller ones took the opportunity to exchange and to show time to time the complexity, the difficulties to implement new standards, or the importance of the financial disclosures which go along with new standards. It's a lot of burden, and I think it was very useful for me too. And I think I invite everyone, when there is the occasion, to get a trustee in his location to profit from this to try to make a short but a very useful meeting. It was really interesting. And I hope that trustees and the member of the staff or the ISB board members have benefited from this.
Thank you, Patrice. You may recall, we did discuss non-GAAP measures at a previous meeting. I think it's on our list of things to keep an eye on, with a view to potentially bringing it back to a future meeting for more discussion. Certainly, putting on my Canadian hat for a moment in terms of our IFRS transition, the Canadian board continues to watch very closely how things play out. The inferences are really drawn from the absence of major eruptions and howls of complaint. There's been very little of that. The sense is the process is playing out reasonably well. Charles, my sense on the non-GAAP issue is I'm sure all of us have heard very similar sorts of observations. Certainly we have, in the context of Canadian GAAP. I've seen it in the context of U.S. GAAP. It just seems inevitable that these sorts of metrics arise. The two areas that are still of some considerable concern in Canada, sort of a good news, bad news thing. One is investment companies, and people watch with keen interest as the board continues its debate and hopefully concludes it fairly quickly on that topic. The other, which has not gone well, in fact, my judgment, things have gotten worse instead of better, would be the question of rate-regulated accounting and what is or is not a reasonable interpretation of the standards. I think a couple of years ago there seemed to be a consensus view. You may not have agreed with the view, but there seemed to be agreement. As the debate has played on, my sense is there's more diversity of views now than there was two or three years ago. And so that's just an issue. And Hans, I'm sure you're getting tired of hearing this particular topic, and you'll have your chance for a reaction. But I would think, in terms of the Canadian board, that is the single most troublesome issue that the board faces, not wanting to wade into the discussion, absolutely not wanting to issue a guidance note or interpretation.
But on the other hand, saying, my goodness, it's taking an incredible amount of energy and frustration on the part of may not be a huge number of entities, but a very significant part of our economy, and I suspect others. So I know that's a sensitivity, and certainly is one of particular interest to us and possibly others. Is there, and members have any comments or questions? Otherwise, I think I've managed to stir you on, so shall we turn to the update? Would you?
The update on activities?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you very much, Paul, and nice to be here and to see so many familiar faces and also some new faces. I would like to tell you a little bit about where we stand with the board. When we put out the agenda consultation, one feedback that we all got was first priority for the new agenda is to finish the existing agenda, and we are still very much busy to do so. Our agenda is still very much dominated by the big convergence projects, which have all been delayed, as you know. And I have here in my speaking notes saying words saying, delays from 2011 deadline reflect ISB being cautious, reflective, and responsive. And this is the truth and nothing but the truth. It is indeed, I can imagine that many of the people working on the standards or waiting for the standards, that it is frustrating, the pace that we are working at. Well, the pace was extremely high last year, and the whole world, including members of the FSB, members of the monitoring board, they all asked us, please slow down. This is crazy what you're doing. And so that is what we did. All the projects went into a slower pace, and I think that was a wise decision. It gave us more time to be responsive. It gave us more time to be careful with due process. I must also say that, so it was indeed a question of being responsive to requests from the outside world. Nevertheless, now that these delays have happened, some are getting a bit restless again. Insurance industry is asking us where the heck is our standard. The SEC is understandably a bit nervous about the financial instruments projects. And even the FSB, where indeed most members wanted us to slow down, now they're telling us, please converge quicker. So it's very hard to find the right pace. Let me put it this way. I must also say that working with in this convergence mode, it is quite a challenge. And it is only because we have such an excellent relationship with our American colleagues of the FASB that it works at all. Because to align two boards with two completely different sets of constituents, and to align two staffs. And one of the boards is working with the knowledge that the more successful we are with converging, the more likely it is that position will change. It is an absolute miracle that we get anything done. And as I said, it is because the professionals from the colleagues from the FASB are truly wonderful, wonderful professionals, and we have good personal relationships. I work very well with Leslie Zeitman, and that's the way that we get things done. Sometimes we don't get them done, then we decide, okay, let's not try to converge all the way, but let's not beat this to death. Let's just accept that we're a little bit apart. And that's how we progress. Just briefly on the Big Four, you'll get quite a good overview from Sue on financial instruments. So just a couple of general statements. First of all, on impairment, we had quite a few false starts there. Whenever we thought that we had found something that made sense economically, the banks told us that it wouldn't work in their systems. And whenever they came with ideas of how it should be done, then it didn't make sense from an accounting purpose point of view. So we had quite a few false starts, but I think now we have found a stable solution on the so-called three-bucket approach, which has been dubbed by one of the team members of the Basel Committee the good, the bad, and the ugly. All loans in principle start in the first bucket, a good bucket. You start provisioning there on a general basis, and then as loans worsen, they go to bucket two or bucket three. We have general agreement on that. We are still wrestling with a couple of technicalities, but we are quite confident that we can get this done in the first half of 2012, and then we'll be able to issue an ED. Classification and measurement. As you know, we deferred IFRS 9 effective date until the 1st of January 2015. In December 2011, unanimously supported around the world. There we go again. Always support for deferrals. And then in January 2012, we decided not to unanimous support around the world. I know that down under, not even everybody was completely happy about it, but we decided to open up IFRS 9 in a limited way, and the board has decided upon that in the meantime. Limited way because we do not want to disadvantage those who have adopted IFRS 9 early, and we do not want to open the can of worms completely and rediscuss everything. We will focus our discussions on the question whether we may need a separate measurement for remeasurement through OCI of certain debt securities. And we will look at the question of bifurcation. Do we need it, or can we clarify the current requirements? The reasons why we did this is for two reasons. First of all, we felt that we might need this additional bucket, measurement technique, for the insurance standard. We are still trying to come to grips with a couple of volatility issue in the insurance standard, and we felt we might need OCI for that. And secondly, we felt that the distance with the Americans, with the FASB, with US GAAP, on such an important standard, it was simply a little bit too big. And we would, as you know, the Americans require all debt instruments to be fair value through OCI. I don't think we will get completely to that position. Hopefully, the Americans will also allow certain debt instruments to be measured at amortized cost. But we will try to come closer together than we are now. General hedge accounting, Sue will be telling you about that too. We've completed our redeclarations. We are putting a staff draft on the internet for about 90 days for the world to familiarize itself with this excruciatingly complicated way of accounting, and also to give the FASB some time to consider their own next steps, because they are a bit behind in this respect. Macro hedge accounting
we will. We have been working very hard on that. We think we might go for a discussion paper before we go to an ED, and Sue will tell you a little bit more about this too. About offsetting, I think I don't need. We have finished the discussions, deliberations. Didn't get completely converged. unfortunately, are trying to resolve the issue as much as possible through disclosures. Then leases. The deliberations are substantially complete. We have a meeting in February on the final issues next week, and I am absolutely, and I know my board, are absolutely determined that this is going to be the last meeting and that we are going to take the final decisions. The issues that are still on our table are not the bigger ones. It is about lessee accounting, how to run off the lease liability through the P&L, and the many people have a big problem with the front loading of interest expense in the current model. That is all very well, but to find an alternative for that is not so simple. I think we have now three models for the world. I think we should make a choice. If we cannot make a choice, we should present two models, and the world should tell us what to do. Because to tell you the truth, there is no objective answer here. There is no objective truth. The world is completely divided. And why is the world completely divided? Well, to tell you the truth, many people simply do not want this standard. They don't like the leasing standard. They don't want to put these things on the balance sheet. I think it is essential that we do so. Every investor knows these are true liabilities, that they should be put on the balance sheets one way or another, and that's what we are going to do. And I think we should be able to issue an ED by the late second quarter of 2012. Revenue recognition. We re-exposed in November 2011. There are public discussions to be held in May 2012 globally, and we hope to finalize in 2012 or early 2013. Then finally, a couple of words on insurance. Very difficult standard, also very difficult to get converged with the United States, given the fact that we have very different markets, very different constituents, the fact that the US already has a standard. IFRS does not have a proper standard, and we are also a part in ideas, but also a part in timing. Nevertheless, what we are trying to do is to have, we have already reached different decisions on a couple of issues, for example, single margin versus risk adjustment. locking versus unlocking. A couple of important differences. We are going to take another look with the FASB at the differences to see how essential they are, how close together we can get, and even if we don't get completely converged, perhaps we can get a little bit more converged than we do now. All I know, it is absolutely essential for our constituents that we get this done. We cannot live in limbo for another couple of years. This is a very important industry. Charles was just talking about proliferation of non-GAAP measures. That is all very well as long as you can reconciliate to the true figures. And if there is an underlying rigor of IFRS, then I am not so worried about these non-GAAP measures. although it is very telling that in 70% the profits are higher than they would otherwise be. investors be aware. In our part of the world, in the IFRS part of the world, the fact that there is no standard means that this this industry is completely dominated by non-GAAP measures, and that is simply unacceptable. It gives a total lack of comparability, and it increases the cost of capital of this industry above the level where it should be. So we have to go on, and we will get it done. Well, after these firm words, Paul, perhaps I can stop here, and I'm happy to take any questions if they're there.
Thank you, Hans. I guess we could start out exhorting you to speed up, and then once you accelerate, we'll turn around and urge you to slow down. So, just one of my colleagues back home says, the best you can strive for is equalized unhappiness.
Spread it around. Well, that's what I always try to. But I have never been in a position where I have been asked to slow down so often in my life. Usually it has always been the opposite. Speed up, speed up, speed up. But this is a different role.
Well, you've covered a lot of ground. We have financial instruments as a separate agenda item. Before opening it for questions and comments from members, I just wonder if Ian or Alan or Sue had anything you wanted to add.
I guess, Paul, on a slightly different topic, we've now got the trustee strategy review out, and we're beginning to actively work to implement the recommendations in that document in a planned and good process way. There's a lot of points in there. There's post-implementation reviews, and you know, we're getting started on the first one on segments. There's the reaching out and implementation assistance, and that combines with it how IFRIC operates. We're moving forward on that. Working with national standard setters and regional standard setting operations. We're trying to move ahead on that at the moment. So there's a number of other things going on in the background as well as just setting standards.
And I think the observation has been made by a number of people in the context of the agenda consultation that whereas we originally were thinking in terms of post-2011, it seems more likely that 2012 and perhaps a good chunk of 2013 is already pretty much taken up with the completion of these really important and monster projects in a way. So, which actually may be a good thing in the sense of allowing for us to raise our sights, think ahead 2 or 3 years, and make sure that we've got our priorities correct. I invite comments, questions from members, and questions of Hans relative to the ISB update. Christoph.
Just a quick note to give some positive feedback. I'm receiving very positive feedback on the outreach activity that the ISB is doing. So if you look back some 3 odd years and think about IA37 and things like the board doesn't listen, that appears to change significantly in the views of the people I'm dealing with. So the boards appear to be doing a very good job. Not everyone is happy with the outcome of the standards, but as Judith said, it would be strange if we ever had an exposure draft without controversy.
Thanks, Christoph. No other comments, questions? Yes, Thomas.
Well, thank you. Just from my personal view, I think it was a very good decision to suggest that for IFRS 9 we move forward to 2015, and that gives a good sign also for a sound and good discussion for all the other standards. Because I think at the end, I mean, the board has to decide about prioritizing Optus projects. What we have seen during the last 3 years is that there are probably too many projects on the agenda for the board, And what we're seeing now is that we are moving away, not to slow down. Slow down seems to be negative, probably, from a point of view of people who want to set standards. But I think where we are moving is that we have a more substantive discussion before we reach a decision in which direction we want to go. And that gives more security also for the users, also for the regulators. I think that is a very important step in another direction. We come back to the, to the agenda consultation later on, but I think it's a change in thinking. And I must say, yes, there is pressure from different institutions that we now need new standards. But I think at the moment we are in a little bit in a lucky situation that we could say, yes, we take the time which we have and we use it with outreach and also with bilateral discussions with the users and the regulators. So it's a positive signal, which is what I wanted to give.
Thanks. Just one of the questions I've got, kind of looking at the other spectrum, one of the big constituents in the areas where we work in Africa are the IFRS for SME users. Now, I know that there's an intention to relook at it now, but let's be honest, it's a very, very ambitious agenda just to get the full IFRS out in the next short while. So how does the beginning of relooking at that standard fit in with the board's plans in terms of the next, say, 12, 18 months?
Yeah, thanks, Bruce. We were always obligated to relook at the SME standard after 3 years, and that is now. So that will go ahead as planned, along with our current other projects. And we'll be beginning on that shortly. Paul Pachter will be leading it, and in fact, Daryl Scott will be helping him as well, so you'll have South African input.
But that's a useful reminder. The IFRS for SMEs doesn't perhaps come up as often in our deliberations as perhaps it should. You may recall we had a presentation from Paul Pachter in terms of branding and other issues not too long ago. One of the sectors that I think the trustees have targeted in terms of the composition of the council was to draw in a few more members who have a SME background in the hopes that that would enable us to make sure that, you know, we're sensitive to the issues facing that sector as well as the listed companies. Sorry, Jim.
Thank you, Paul. Could I just ask about post-implementation reviews? And I don't necessarily mean segmented reporting specifically, but what sort of timeline do we think is involved in doing any one of these? How much effort is involved? I guess I'm concerned between the importance of getting it right and the importance of how much time both staff and the board take in doing them.
We're all fighting for the microphone. So at the moment, the first post-implementation review is IFRS 8, the operating segments. We're using that as our learning process. How long does it take? It depends. And I tell you what, every time, you know, if we say it's going to take a year, people say, well, it sounds like you're over-engineering this, and why would it take a year to do something like that? But on the other hand, they should just take as long as we need to. Just to give you a bit of a sense of the flavour of what we're doing, the idea is that they're basically split into three sort of phases, and I guess two fundamental phases. The very first thing you've got to do is to set out the scope of what you're looking at. And we know there's been a lot of debate amongst the Advisory Council and others about the scope. They originally were set out to have a look at the issues that were most contentious, but I think it goes without saying that everything we do in financial reporting is about improving, so we're not going to go blindly into this and just and limit artificially the analysis. But on the other hand, this is also not an opportunity for us to relitigate and go back to the same arguments that we debated when we first put the standard in place. So, and I'll use my language in this, but the first phase of information gathering about setting the scope is about looking at the impressions or perceptions that people have about the standard. I think if you go around, and the team so far has already started to talk to a lot of users, for example, preparers and standard setters and others, to gain an impression as to what they think has happened with the implementation, in this case, of the operating segment standard. If And of course, this is probably not going to happen. If everybody was in raging agreement that was a wonderful success, financial reporting had been improved and the cost of implementation was very low, we might just simply stop there. What we would do is report back to our board that that's what we found. We'd report back to the due process oversight committee that the initial impression was very, very favourable. We didn't see any areas of concern. But if we are hearing areas where people say, well, chopping and changing segments, we've lost information, too much non-gap information, for example, that's giving you an impression of some areas where there might be concern over and above those issues that we identified when we first developed the standard. And so having done that, we'll report to the board in public session where we'll set out what we think is the right level of analysis or the right scope to undertake. Then the idea is that we do a deeper analysis after that, which involves interviews, collecting more data. Then that's where we really are going to rely on our fellows, the standard setters, as part of the broader community, to give us more feedback. Having collected that information, we'll report that publicly again, and we'll share and be very transparent about the instruments we use. As I said, it could be quite deep analysis, quite intense interviews with users and others, depending on what the initial first impressions or scope have identified. Then we'll prepare an interim report, the board have a look, and again, would be placed on public website, discussed in public, and report back. So how long does that take? Of course, it depends on the first part of it. And if it looks like it's a fairly narrow scope, we might be able to do something quite quickly. Yeah, so it will depend on the project. And just one little thing aside too, we have this constant, and it's come up here over quite often, about it's too early because you won't really find out what the improvements in reporting are. I was reviewing a study a couple of weeks ago on adoption of fair values for investment properties. They used 5 years' worth of data, either side of 2005. So we're not going to see a lot of academic studies and other work like that for a little bit of time. But others had said it's too late, because by the time you're 2 years down the track, you've missed all the little bits and pieces that perhaps you should have found at the time. Or what we're trying to emphasise is this post-implementation review is just part of a process. If we have already got an annual improvements process and an interpretations committee to identify those problems, perhaps teething problems when the first standard first came out. And if it's too early to identify long-term benefits or to assess properly, we will report that to the board and the due process oversight committee. And I think the board has an option then of saying, well, perhaps we'll come back to that, maybe as part of another triennial review, agenda consultation, or perhaps they'll say we don't need to do any more. But again, we'll continually look at the scope to see whether we should do more or whether we should constrain it. Because I think the board is quite keen to make sure that these don't become bigger than the standard itself. We could spend more time doing post-implementation review than developing something. So I hope that's given a bit of a sense. So, and we're looking at, I think, Michael, probably around about November, December for trying to wrap up the segment reporting. So we're looking at 9 to 12 months for that one.
Thanks, Alan. I think that's helpful. My experience would be that moving quickly on a global scale is hard to reconcile to with finishing something in a year. It just and my experience is that it usually pays off to take whatever time is necessary to allow people to feel they've had the opportunity of providing input. Alan, as you said, some people have worried that if you move too quickly, the problems tend to surface early on, and the costs tend to be more obvious than some of the benefits. So there, I think as long as you're sensitive to the fact that there's that potential bias that it takes longer to evaluate the full benefits to the extent that they're there, so it may be difficult to get a confidence in terms of whether the benefits have materialized in a couple of years. But having said that, you're probably better off to do less ambitious reviews, an initial one on a timely basis before the problems get too deeply embedded, if indeed there are problems, with the possibility of revisiting the issue a second time, if needs be later on, rather than over-engineering a review that might span several years, you know, in the hopes that it could be all-inclusive and definitive. I think very few things are definitive in this world when it comes to financial reporting. Other comments, reactions? Yes, by all means, Rudy.
Rudy is my name, by the way. I know you can't see that far, as you said before. I just wanted to remark, I appreciated very much the comments with respect to the way the ISB and the FASB are working together. I just wanted to hear the chairman's thoughts looking forward from a more broader general perspective, how the two boards would be collaborating to, you know, with the objective, hopefully, of either aligning or continue to try to converge the standards more generally.
Well, that's a very interesting question, of course. Interesting thing is that both Leslie and myself, during the same conference, said in our speeches that convergence has to come to an end, that it cannot be a continuous platform, because it's simply too difficult and too unstable, and you don't always reach the right decisions. Obviously, when after the United States has made a decision, we'll hear a little bit more about it from Jim later, but let's suppose that's going to be a positive decision, then the relationship is going to change. But what is not going, and we will, I don't think we will have the frequency of the joint meetings that we have now. But obviously the FESB will remain extremely important to us because they will be the main endorsement agency in the United States. And if we develop a standard and we do that without any sort of consultation with the FESB, such as we consult around the world, and we do not take into serious consideration concerns that are raised by the FESB, then we would certainly get into serious trouble. So it will remain a vital relationship. And we have more of these relationships. We have a relationship with Europe, with EFREC, with the Commission. And I think that in the future, we will probably have to find ways to have a more institutional framework for all of these relationships. Because if we only have informal bilateral relations with all these very important organizations around the world, then the potential for chaos is just immense. And I think it would also be very good that organizations like EFREC and FESB, let's say the Japanese Standards Setting Board, that they also have a platform where they meet together, such as they already do bilaterally. But if we want to avoid a complete conundrum of bilateral relations in which nobody knows from each other exactly what they're doing and where they stand, then this is going to be a very chaotic and hard to control world. So I think that now that we have completed this strategy review and the review of the monitoring board, that the real work still has to start. And I think one of Yael's new tasks will be to develop a strategy as to how to go forward and to develop very intensive relationships with all these organizations. I have some vague notions on how this might work, but not more than that. And I really think that your question is truly going to be the main challenge for the next years, not just in relation to the FASB, although that will obviously be extraordinarily, it will always remain a very intensive relationship, but also with other constituents around the world.
Thanks, Hans. And as you know, there are new players on the scene, regional bodies and tremendous expressions of interest. I think you're not short in terms of offers to help. As you said, the trick is really going to be to coordinate the arrangements and perhaps formalize them in a way that we don't have at the moment. And I find it reassuring that I think we're not assuming that we'll just carry on with the current model. And what I'm hearing is not clear yet what arrangements might be appropriate in the future, but that's something that you'll be looking at, and presumably the council will have ample opportunity to weigh in on. David?
Yeah, I think just to add one thing to that, I think there's an aspect of timing of intervention that's important too, that it clearly takes a while to develop a standard. You want engagement through the development. You don't want people who have actually, in an informal way, been engaged throughout the life cycle of a project and then suddenly raise a bunch of issues when it comes to endorsement. So I think some of this is how we ensure through the life cycle of a project that the engagement satisfies those people who may ultimately endorse a standard, that they've been sufficiently involved. They may not like the answer, but they're satisfied that it's has been sufficiently thought through that they can accept it without a two-year period of thinking it through again or making individual carve-outs or local twists in implementation.
And I think that's a topic that we can add to our laundry list of potential agenda items for a future meeting or meetings to discuss sort of global arrangements that seem appropriate on a go-forward basis.
We need a meeting in Bretton Woods.
Any other comments, questions? If not, we're running a bit ahead of schedule. Jim, I wonder, would you like to take advantage of the time? I suspect there's keen interest in your report, so please, over to you.
Thanks, Paul, and thanks very much for the invitation. Happy to update you with respect to what's going on in the U.S. environment. Of course, on this topic, as important as any topic, that I give the disclaimer, because I'm one person who doesn't get to vote, and there are five who will, so my views today are my own. And along the way, please feel free, if you have questions, just put up your tent card or flag Paul. You can stop me in the middle of my remarks if there's something that you want to comment on or you want to follow up. Or feel free to ask questions at the end as well. But let me hit right at the start that the decision last year to take a few additional months' time should not be read as anything other than that. There's, you know, certainly those would look and say, well, is that somehow a negative indicator with respect to what's going on in the U.S.? And let me just outline a few of the factors that are going on environmentally. In the U.S., we made a decision in 2010 to embark upon a work plan that called for consideration in 2011, but also indicated that important to that determination were the governance review, the status of the convergence projects. But if you think about in 2010 when we made that determination, it was February. Subsequent to that, there was an act that was put in place, the Dodd-Frank Act, that called upon the Commission to do more than 100 rulemakings and studies, unprecedented in its magnitude since the creation of the agency. So literally tens of thousands of hours have been spent on that act, including statutory deadlines that really do take an enormous amount of commission attention and effort. A decision on IFRS in any normal environment would probably be one of the two or three biggest activities that the commission might be working on in any given point in time. Of course, with the considerations in Dodd-Frank, putting in place a new derivatives regulatory system, dealing with credit rating agencies, hedge funds, not saying any one of those individually is bigger than the consideration of IFRS, but there's certainly significant activities that do require significant effort. So just environmentally, if you think about the changes since 2010,
There have been fairly significant developments. The end of last year, we had a new commissioner join us who will now be participating in the decision. He started close to the end of the year, so if you think about, again, environmentally, just having somebody get up to speed not only on this issue but on the issue of where do we position ourselves or where do we find ourselves with respect to IFRS. Don't want to belabor the point because I think Hans covered very clearly the pressure that the standard setters get to slow down and then to speed up. Certainly that was a consideration that the commission had put in place in 2010 was the status of the MOU work, and at that time I think there were in excess of certainly more than half a dozen, probably closer to 10 MOU projects, and I think very, from my perspective, a very wise decision to narrow that agenda down to the three or four critical items and seen very positive progress on those, save financial instruments where I think the path is maybe becoming clearer to how we get to standards that are more aligned, but still tension between where we find ourselves in the U.S. on things like netting and not yet, as you point out, Hans, aligned on classification, but I think at least a path that looks like a way to narrow those differences. And, of course, that will be important to a commission decision if you think about a standard that was widely divergent. So divergent, it would put us in a much more difficult situation to say, well, we are going to move forward with some form of adoption or incorporation, yet our national standard setter has, in its own best judgment, concluded differently on financial instruments. So I think the more progress we see there, the easier that will make a decision. I certainly don't want to say that we can't move forward in some way absent that, but it does just make the consideration a more difficult one. And then finally, the governance review, which was initially, at least the monitoring board governance review, was initially scheduled to be completed at the end of 2010, was a positive development that is now complete, and that's been important to our consideration of IFRS as well. And that's, I have a draft of the final report, which is several 150 so pages. The one area that it doesn't yet have is the section on the governance review, because those words are probably being written. I guess it's a federal holiday in the U.S. today, so they're not being written maybe today, but they're being written concurrently. And my exercise is now to review this draft. So we really do have real work there, and that's probably the final point, is we needed more time, if for no other reason than my staff and I needed more time to complete the review. So you can see it's real. These aren't blank pages. We have a real final report that we continue to hope that will be completed within that few months' time that I talked about at a conference in December. And concurrent with that, and the report will be a public report. It's a report to the commission, but it's also a report to the public that will cover each of the areas, and I can get into a little detail if folks are interested. Concurrent with that, the staff is working on a proposal for commission consideration. In that proposal, and again, important particularly as I talk about a proposal, that this is staff work at this point, but I am optimistic about a framework, and I talked about a few of the points that I thought would be critical to that framework in a speech in December. So if you're interested, it's on our website, but I can just highlight two or three of those. First and foremost, working on a framework that would show a strong U.S. commitment to the use of international standards, and that those standards would be the standards of the IASB. And I think that is consistent with the feedback that we've gotten from multiple avenues of consultation. We've done that through roundtables, through opportunities to comment on various proposals, including an endorsement approach. And I think that is consistent with the feedback that we've heard, including the feedback from the Financial Accounting Foundation, where in their comment letter they show, first and foremost, that they are supportive of the use of IFRS and that FASB would play the role of bringing those standards to bear. Second, important to the framework to me, is that ultimate responsibility with respect to financial reporting standards in the U.S. would rest with the U.S., and that my personal view would be that the Financial Accounting Standards Board would be that body which would play an endorsement role. And again, keep in mind that these are my personal views. That then touches upon an issue that I know is of interest to many, and that is, if the FASB were to play the role of endorsing standards, what should the threshold for accepting those standards, or more importantly, what the threshold for diverging from those standards would be? We proposed a model, or it wasn't a proposal, I guess we issued a staff thought piece on a model that would say that the threshold should be a relatively high threshold before you would change. And that became a flashpoint for discussion, many saying, how would you prejudge the threshold? Wouldn't it depend upon the outcome? Others saying that that would really take away the FASB's ability to exercise its own best judgment. But on the other hand, a low threshold would put in place the possibility of a U.S. variation of IFRS, and certainly we're aware of those tension points. As we've thought about it, we are thinking that probably the best alternative is to focus more on process as opposed to outcomes. That is, and I think, Hans, this is consistent with what you indicated, that there should be substantive involvement of national standard setters, and I agree with you that that would include not just the U.S., but other major regional or national standard setters, and I'm glad to hear that the thinking is going on around that. I have probably, like you, ideas maybe at this level, but I don't know how they would come together, but I don't think it would be something where we would say there should be differential treatment for the FASB, that multilateral agreements would be important, and that involvement early on would be critical. I think it would help with bringing then a third aspect that would be important to a framework, and that is that the U.S. have a strong voice in the development of standards that would bring that to bear, but I don't think in any way bring that to bear unequal from others who have significant national standard setting or endorsing bodies. I think that would also then help with the endorsement process, those types of arrangements, because if a country found itself in a situation where it was having challenges with respect to incorporation, that they could work with other bodies who then have to sit in the same position, and maybe we would find that issues really aren't, in general, unique around the world. And so that might actually assist not only the U.S., but others in coming to an endorsement or a conclusion to incorporate. Those are probably the key factors to a framework from the endorsement standpoint and the standpoint of ceasing the creation of new differences. And, of course, big issues then come up about how to best transition from the existing standards that we find ourselves with differences to those of the IASB and the IFRS. And those are difficult challenges as well. Paul, you mentioned a couple that were particularly important in Canada, and I think equally important in the U.S., rate-regulated accounting, the accounting for investment companies. We hear very closely from rate-regulated entities that they would go kicking and screaming away from a model where they're recognizing rate-regulated assets and rate-regulated liabilities. We've talked to their investors who find the accounting model, at least in their view, particularly helpful in projecting future cash flows. And so there are those differences, which my personal view is I would not want to let a handful of areas that might be particularly challenging hold up the broader important decision. And so there might be ways that we need to finesse over time that there will be some areas where we might not align on day one, and I don't mean finesse by saying that we're following IFRS as issued by the IASB, but make an important decision and then move on with respect to how do we deal with other areas where there are continuing differences. Another one that's particularly important in the U.S. environment right now is LIFO accounting. Happens to be tied to our tax requirements. My understanding is that the lost tax impact to U.S. entities would be somewhere north of $50 billion on the deduction alone. That's the tax impact, so the gross difference is much bigger. In an environment where people are keenly focused on the bottom line, that's a $50 billion fight to have. Somebody's got a lot of money to, or organizations have a lot of money to have the discussion about how important it is to change or not on LIFO inventory. So there's a handful of those issues that I think will linger, and we'll have to figure out what to do over time. The other aspect of that is whether or not a framework should include the continued use of the idea of U.S. GAAP, one from the standpoint of if we were to have some handful of differences that we have to deal with over time, but also from the standpoint of the fact that U.S. GAAP is embedded in our system throughout multiple levels of federal, state, local, regulatory requirements, including embedded significantly in private party contracts, so that even moving away from the term U.S. GAAP could be exponentially compounding to a decision. And I think, Paul, correct me if I'm wrong, but that is one of the reasons why Canada retained the use of Canadian GAAP and brought IFRS standards into Canadian standards, was to deal with some of those very practical issues of what do you do when a set of standards is just ingrained throughout your system. So those are the aspects of a framework that I think will be important. Again, I'm hopeful that we're on track for a few months' time. I'm not going to get more specific about exactly what a few means. It's something more than a couple and less than many. So I'll preempt that question. You can ask it anyway, but I'm not going to get any more specific, in part because it then focuses people on a day, and it really takes more of our staff's energy focusing on that day and whether we're going to hit the day than actually doing our real work of getting the report done. I'm happy to take any and all questions.
Thanks, Jim. My suggestion is that we take our break. The incentive to get back quickly is it'll allow more time to pepper Jim with your questions. So if we could, please try to be back by 11 a.m., and then we'll resume.
Nah, that's not...